The palaces were meant to impress the viewer with the wealth, might, and spirit of the people they represented. Each structure vied for attention with towering columns, elaborate ornamentation, and flamboyant sweeps of windows, roofs, and decorated entablatures. To Tobias Brogan, they looked like nothing more than stone peacocks, an ostentatious waste if he ever had seen one. On a distant rise lay the sprawling Confessor's Palace, its stone columns and spires unmatched by the elegance of King's Row, and somehow whiter than the snow around it, as if trying to mask the profanity of its existence with the illusion of purity. Brogan's stare probed the recesses of that sanctuary of wickedness, the shrine to magic's power over the pious, as his bony fingers idly caressed the leather trophy case at his belt.
"My Lord General," Lunetta pressed, leaning forward. "Did you hear what I said?"
Brogan twisted around, his polished boots creaking against the stirrup leather in the cold.
"Galtero!"
Eyes like black ice shone from under the brow of a polished helmet beneath a horsehair plume dyed crimson to match the soldiers' capes. He held his reins easily in one gauntleted hand as he swayed in his saddle with the fluid grace of a mountain lion.
"Lord General, if my sister can't keep quiet when ordered to," he shot her a glare, "gag her!"
Lunetta darted an uneasy glance at the broad-shouldered man riding beside her, at his polished to perfection armor and mail, at his well-honed weapons. She opened her mouth to protest, but as she returned her gaze to those icy eyes, she closed it again and instead scratched her arms.
"Forgive me, Lord General Brogan,"
she murmured, as she bowed her head deferentially toward her brother. Galtero aggressively sidestepped his horse closer to Lunetta, his powerful gray gelding jostling her bay mare.
"Silence, Dragonicha!"
Her cheeks colored at the affront, and her eyes, for an instant, flashed with menace. But just as quickly it was gone, and she seemed to wilt into her tattered rags as her eyes lowered in submission.
"I'd not be a witch,"
she whispered to herself. A brow lifted over one cold eye, causing her to sag further, and she fell silent for good. Galtero was a good man. The fact that Lunetta was sister to Lord General Brogan would count for nothing if the order were ever given. She was Straganicha, one tainted by evil. Given the word, Galtero or any of the other men would spill her lifeblood without a moment's hesitation or regret. That she was Brogan's kin only hardened him to his duty. She served as a constant reminder of the Keeper's ability to strike out at the righteous and blight even the finest of families. 7 years after Lunetta's birth, the Creator had balanced the injustice, and Tobias had been born, to counter what the Keeper had corrupted. But it had been too late for their mother, who had already begun to slip into the arms of madness. From the time he was 8, when the disrepute had delivered his father into an early grave, and his mother had finally and fully nestled into the bosom of madness, Tobias had been burdened with the duty of ruling the gift his sister possessed, lest it rule her. At that age, Lunetta had doted on him, and he had used that love to convince her to listen only to the Creator's wishes, and to guide her in moral conduct, the way the men of the King's Circle had schooled him. Lunetta had always needed, in fact embraced, guidance. She was a helpless soul trapped by a curse that was beyond her ability to expunge or her power to escape. Through ruthless effort, he had cleansed the ignominy of having one with the gift born into his family. It had taken most of his life, but Tobias had returned honor to the family name. He had shown them all. He had turned the stigma to his advantage, and had become the most exalted among the exalted. Tobias Brogan loved his sister, loved her enough to slit her throat himself, if need be, to free her from the Keeper's tendrils, from the torment of his taint, if it ever slipped the bounds of control. She would live only so long as she was useful, only so long as she helped them root out evil, root out banelings. For now, she fought the scourge snatching at her soul, and she was useful. He realized she didn't look like much, swathed in scraps of different colored cloth. It was the one thing that brought her pleasure and kept her content, having different colors draped around her, her pretties, she called them. But the Keeper had invested Lunetta with rare talent and strength. Through tenacious effort, Tobias had expropriated it. That was the flaw in the Keeper's creation, the flaw in anything the Keeper created. It could be used as a tool by the pious if they were astute enough. The Creator always provided weapons to fight profanity, if one only looked for them and had the wisdom, the sheer audacity, to use them. That was what impressed him about the Imperial Order. They were shrewd enough to understand this, and resourceful enough to use magic as a tool to seek out profanity and destroy it. As he did, the Order used Stregonicha, and apparently valued and trusted them. He didn't like it, though, that they were allowed to roam free and unguarded to bring information and proposals. But if they ever turned against the cause, well, he always kept Lunetta nearby. Still, he didn't like being so close to evil. It repulsed him, sister or not. Dawn was just breaking, and the streets were already crowded with people. In abundance, too, were soldiers of different lands, each patrolling the grounds of their own palaces, and others, mostly Daharan, patrolling the city. Many of the troops looked ill at ease, as if they anticipated an attack at any moment. Brogan had been assured that they had everything well in hand. Never one to take on faith anything he was told, he had sent out his own patrols the night before, and they had confirmed that there were no Midland insurgents anywhere near Adendrill. Brogan always favored arriving when least expected, and in greater numbers than expected, just in case he had matters into his own hands. He had brought a full fist, 500 men, into the city, but if there proved to be trouble, he could always bring his main force into Adendrill. His main force had proven themselves quite capable of crushing any insurrection. Had the Daharans not been allies, the indications of their numbers would have been alarming. Though Brogan had well-founded faith in his men's abilities, only the vain fought battles when the odds were even, much less long. The Creator didn't hold the vain in kind regard. Lifting a hand, Tobias slowed the horses, lest they trample a squad of Daharan foot soldiers crossing before the column. He thought it untoward of them to be winged out in a battle formation, similar to his own flying wedge as they crossed the main thoroughfare. But perhaps the Daharans, charged with the task of patrolling a vanquished city, were reduced to frightening footpads and cutpurses with a show of might. The Daharans, weapons to hand and looking to be in an ill mood, swept gazes over the column of cavalry bearing down on them, apparently looking for any sign of threat. Brogan thought it rather odd that they carried their weapons unsheathed. A cautious lot, the Daharans. Unconcerned with what they saw, they didn't hurry their pace. Brogan smiled. Lesser men would have stepped up their stride. Their weapons, mostly swords and battle axes, were neither embellished nor fancy, and that in itself made them look all the more impressive. They were weapons carried because they had proven brutally effective and not for flash. Outnumbered well over 20-fold, the men in dark leather and mail regarded all the polished metal with indifference. Polish and precision often displayed nothing more than conceit, and although in this case they were a reflection of Brogan's discipline, a display of deadly attention to detail, the Daharans probably didn't know that. Where he and his men were better known, a glimpse of their crimson capes was enough to make strong men blanch, and the glint off their polished armor was enough to make an enemy break and run. When they had come across the Rang Shida Mountains from Nicobarisi, Brogan had met with one of the Order's armies, made up of men of many nations, but mostly Dahara, and had been impressed with the Daharan's general, Riggs, who had accepted counsel with interest and attention. Brogan, in fact, had been so impressed with the man that he had left some of his own troops with him to help in the conquest of the Midlands. The Order had been on its way to bring the heathen city of Abinissia, the crown city of Galia, to heel under the Order. The Creator willing, they had succeeded. Brogan had learned that Daharans didn't hold much favor with magic, and that pleased him. That they also feared magic disgusted him. Magic was the Keeper's conduit into the world of man. The Creator was to be feared. Magic, the Keeper's witchery, was to be expunged. Until the boundary had been brought down the past spring, Dahara had been cordoned off from the Midlands for generations. So in large part, Dahara and its people were still an unknown to Brogan, a vast new territory in need of enlightenment and possibly purification. Darkan Rahl, the leader of Dahara, had brought the boundary down, allowing his troops to sweep into the Midlands and capture Adendrill, among other cities. If he had been more interested in confining himself to the affairs of man, Rahl might have seized all of the Midlands before they could raise armies against him, but he had been more interested in pursuing magic, and that had been his undoing. Once Darkan Rahl was dead, assassinated by a pretender to the throne, as Brogan had heard it told, the Daharan troops had joined with the Imperial Order in its cause. There was no longer a place in the world for the ancient, dying religion called magic. The Imperial Order was upon the world now. The Creator's glory would guide man. Tobias Brogan's prayers had been answered, and every day he thanked the Creator for placing him in the world at this time, when he could be the center of it all, to see the blasphemy of magic vanquished, to lead the righteous in the final battle. This was the making of history, and he was part of it. The Creator, in fact, had recently come to Tobias in his dreams to tell him how pleased he was with his efforts. He didn't reveal this to any of his men. That might be seen as presumptuous. To be honored by the Creator was satisfaction enough. Of course, he had told Lunetta, and she had been awed. After all, it wasn't often the Creator chose to speak directly to one of his children. Brogan squeezed his legs around his horse to pick up the pace as he watched the Daharans move on down a side street. None turned to see if they were to be followed or challenged, but only a fool would take that for complacency. Brogan was no fool. The throng parted for the column, giving them a wide path as they proceeded down King's Row. Brogan recognized some of the uniforms of soldiers at various palaces. Sandarians, Jarians, and Keltans. He saw no Galeans. The Order must have been successful in their task at Galea's crown city of Ebenicia. At last Brogan saw troops from his homeland. With an impatient wave, he signaled a squad forward. Their capes, crimson to announce who they were, billowed out behind as they charged past the swordsmen, lancers, standard-bearers, and finally Brogan. Accompanied by the racket of iron shoes on stone, the horsemen charged right up the vast steps of the Nicobarese Palace. It was an edifice as garish as any of the others, with tapered, fluted columns of rare, white-veined brown marble, a difficult-to-obtain stone quarried from the mountains in eastern Nicobarese. The profligacy galled him. The regular soldiers guarding the palace stumbled back at the sight of the men on horseback and flinched into shaky salutes. The squad of horsemen herded them back further, opening a wide corridor for the Lord General. At the top of the steps, between statues of soldiers atop rearing stallions, carved from buff-colored stone, Brogan dismounted. He tossed the reins to one of the ashen-faced palace guard as he smiled out at the city, his eyes settling on the confessor's palace. Today, Tobias Brogan was in a good mood. Lately, such moods were becoming increasingly rare. He drew a deep breath of the dawn air, the dawn of a new day. The man who had taken the reins bowed as Brogan turned back.
"Long live the king!"
Brogan straightened his cape.
"A little late for that."
The man cleared his throat, working up the courage.
"Sir?"
"The king," Brogan said, as he knuckled his mustache. "Turned out to be more than all of us who loved him thought. He burned for his sins. Now, see to my horse."
He gestured to another guard.
"You, go tell the cooks I'm hungry. I don't want to be kept waiting."
The guard backed away, bowing, as Brogan glanced up at the man still on horseback.
"Galtero."
The man stepped his horse closer, his crimson cape limp in the still air.
"Take half the men and bring her to me. I'm going to breakfast, and then I will judge her."
With a gentle touch, his bony fingers absently stroked the case at his belt. Soon he would add the prize of prizes to his collection. He smiled grimly at the thought, the smile tightening the old scar at the corner of his mouth, but not touching his dark eyes. The glory of moral redress would be his.
"Lunetta."
She was staring at the confessor's palace, her motley patches of tattered cloth drawn tight to her as she idly scratched her forearms.
"Lunetta!"
She flinched, hearing him at last.
"Yes, Lord General."
He flipped his crimson cape back over his shoulder and straightened his sash of rank.
"Come, break fast with me. We'll have a talk. I'll tell you about the dream I had last night."
Her eyes widened with excitement.
"Another one, my Lord General? Yes, I should like very much to hear about it. You honor me."
"Indeed."
She followed as he marched through the tall, brass-bound double doors into the Nicobarese Palace.
"We have matters to discuss.
You will listen attentively, won't you, Lunetta?" She shuffled along at his heels.
"Yes, my Lord General, always."
He paused at a window with a heavy blue drape. Drawing his dress knife, he sliced a good-sized piece from the side, including a strip of edging with gold tassels. Licking her lips, Lunetta rocked from side to side, shifting her weight from one foot to the other as she waited. Brogan smiled.
"A pretty for you, Lunetta."
Eyes glistening, she clutched it excitedly to herself before holding it in one place, then another, searching for the perfect spot to add it to the others. She giggled with glee.
"Thank you, Lord General. It'd be beautiful."
He marched off, Lunetta scurrying to follow behind. Portraits of royalty hung from the rich paneling, and underfoot, sumptuous carpets ran into the distance. gold-leafed frames surrounded round-topped doors to either side. Gilt-edged mirrors reflected the passing flash of crimson. A servant in brown and white livery bowed his way into the hall, holding out his arm to indicate the direction to the dining hall before scuttling along, looking sideways to be sure he kept himself clear of harm and bowing every few steps. Tobias Brogan was not a man who had ever frightened anyone with his size, but the servants, staff, palace guard, and partially dressed officials who charged into the hall to see what was causing such a fuss all paled at the sight of him, at seeing the Lord General himself, the man who commanded the blood of the fold. At his word, banelings burned for their sins, whether they be beggars or soldiers, lords or ladies, or even kings. Chapter 5. Sister Verna stood transfixed by the flames, their depths loosing transient whorls of glittering colors and shimmering rays, alive with swaying movement, fingers twisting in a dance, luring an air that flapped their clothes in passing, and casting forth heat that would have driven them all back if not for their shields. The huge, blood-red sun hung half-emerged at the horizon, at last abating the glory of the fire that had consumed the bodies. A few of the sisters around her still sobbed softly, but Sister Verna had drained all the tears she had to give. Well, over 100 boys and young men stood in a ring around the fire, with twice as many sisters of the light and novices circled inside them, except for one sister and one boy symbolically standing watch over the palace. And, of course, the one sister who had become deranged and was locked in an empty, shielded room for her own good, all were on the hill above Tanamura, watching the flames leap skyward. Even with this many people standing together, each was touched by profound loneliness and stood withdrawn in introspection and prayer. As prescribed, no one spoke at the funeral rite. Sister Verna's back hurt from standing ward all night over the bodies. Through the hours of darkness, they had all stood, praying and maintaining the linked shield over the corpses in symbolic protection of the revered. At least it was a relief to be away from the incessant drumming down in the city. At first light, the shield had been dropped, and each had sent forth a flow of her han into the pyre, igniting it. Fire, fed by magic, had raced through the stacked logs and the two heavily shrouded bodies, one short and squat, the other tall and powerfully built, creating an inferno of divine power. They had had to search the vaults for guidance, as no one living had ever participated in the ceremony. It had not been performed in almost 800 years, 791 to be precise, the last time a prelate had died. As they had learned in the old books, only the prelate was to have her soul released to the Creator's protection in the sacred funeral rite. But in this case, the sisters had all voted to grant the same privilege to the one who had struggled so valiantly to save her. The books had said that dispensation from the exclusion could only be granted by unanimous consent. It had taken heated persuasion to make it so. By custom, as the sun finally and fully gained the horizon, washing the fire with the complete spectacle of the Creator's own light, the flow of han was withdrawn. Their power recalled, the pyre collapsed, leaving only a stain of ash and a few charred logs to mark the site of the ceremony on the green hilltop. Smoke curled upward, dissipating into the silent, brightening day. Grayish, white ashes were all that was left in the world of the living of Prelate Annalena and the Prophet Nathan. It was done. Without words, sisters began drifting away, some in solitude, others placing a comforting arm around the shoulder of a boy or a novice. Like lost souls, they meandered down the hill toward the city and the palace of the prophets, going to a home without a mother. As Sister Verna kissed her ring finger, she guessed that with the prophet also dead, they were in a way without a father as well. She folded her fingers together over her stomach as she absently watched the others walking off into the distance. She had never had the chance to make her peace with the prelate before she had died. The woman had used her, humiliated her, and allowed her to be abased for doing her duty and following orders. Though all sisters served the Creator, and she knew that what the prelate had done must have been for a greater good, it hurt that the prelate had exploited that fidelity. It made her feel a fool. Because Prelate Annalena had been injured in the attack by Ulyssia, a sister of the dark, and had since remained unconscious for near to 3 weeks prior to her death, Sister Verna had never had a chance to talk to her. Only Nathan had attended the prelate, trying tirelessly to heal her, but in the end he had failed. It was cruel fate that took his life, too. Though Nathan had always seemed vigorous to her, the strain must have been too much for him. He had, after all, been near to 1,000 years old. She guessed he had aged in the 20-odd years she had been away seeking Richard and finally bringing him to the palace. Sister Verna smiled at the memory of Richard. She missed him, too. He had vexed her to the limits of her tolerance, but he, too, had been a victim of the prelate's plans. Although he seemed to have understood and accepted the things she had done and had not held any ill feelings toward her. She felt a pang of heartache at the thought that Richard's love, Kaelin, had probably died in the climax of that terrible prophecy. She hoped it wasn't so. The prelate had been a resolute woman and had orchestrated events in the lives of a great many people. Sister Verna hoped it had truly been done for the good of the Creator's children and not simply for the prelate's own ambitions.
"You look angry, Sister Verna."
She turned to see young Warren, standing with his hands in the opposite silver brocade sleeves of his deep violet robes. She glanced around and realized that the two of them were alone on the hillside. The others, long gone, were dark specks in the distance.
"Perhaps I am, Warren. What are you angry about, sister?"
With the palms of her hands, she smoothed her dark skirt at her hips.
"Maybe I'm just angry with myself."
She sought to change the subject as she straightened her light blue shawl.
"You're so young, in your studies, I mean, that I'm still having trouble getting used to seeing you without a Radahan."
As if she had reminded him, his finger stroked his neck where the collar had been for most of his life.
"Young for those living under the spell at the palace, perhaps, but hardly young for those in the outside world. I am 157, sister. But I do appreciate that you took my collar off."
He took his fingers from his neck and brushed back a lock of curly blonde hair.
"It seems like the whole world has been turned upside down in the last few months."
She chuckled.
"I miss Richard, too."
An easy grin brightened his face.
"Really? He was a rare person, wasn't he? I can hardly believe that he was able to prevent the Keeper from escaping the underworld, but he had to have stopped the spirit of his father and returned the Stone of Tears to its rightful place, or we would all have been swallowed by the dead. To tell the truth, I was in a cold sweat the whole of winter solstice."
Sister Verna nodded, as if to add emphasis to her sincerity.
"The things you helped teach him must have been valuable. You did well too, Warren."
She studied his gentle smile for a moment, noticing how little it had changed over all the years.
"I'm glad you decided to remain at the palace for a time, even though you have your collar off. We are without a prophet, it would seem."
He looked to the stain of ashes.
"Most of my life I've studied the prophecies down in the vaults, and I never knew that some were given by a prophet still living, much less at the palace. I wish they had told me. I wish they had let me talk to him, learn from him. Now the chance is lost."
"Nathan was a dangerous man, an enigma, who none of us could ever fully understand or trust. But maybe it was wrong of them to prevent you from visiting him. Know that, in time, when you learned more, the sisters would have allowed it, if not required it."
He glanced away. "But now the chance has been lost."
"Warren, now that you have the collar off, I know you're anxious to go out into the world. But you've said that you intend to stay at the palace at least for a time to study. The palace is without a prophet now. I think you should consider the fact that your gift manifests itself strongly in that area. You could someday be a prophet."
A gentle breeze rippled his robes as he looked out over the green hills toward the palace. "Not only my gift, but my interest, my hopes have always involved the prophecies. I've only recently begun to understand them in a way that no one else does. But understanding them is different than giving them."
"It takes time, Warren. Why, when Nathan was your age, I'm sure he was no more advanced in prophecy than you. If you stayed and continued to study, I believe that in 400 or 500 years you might be a prophet as great as Nathan."
He was silent for a time. "But there's a whole world out there. I've heard there are books at the Wizard's Keep in Aidendrill, and other places too. Richard said there are sure to be many at the People's Palace in Dahara. I want to learn, and there may be things to know that can't be found here."
Sister Verna rolled her shoulders to ease their ache.
"The Palace of the Prophets is spelled, Warren. If you leave, you will age the same as those outside.
Look at what's happened to me in a scant 20-odd years away from it. Even though we were born only a year apart, you still look as if you should be thinking of marriage, and I look as if I should be preparing to bounce a grandchild on my knee. Now that I'm back, I will age by the palace's time again. But what has been lost cannot be recovered. Warren averted his eyes.
I think you see more wrinkles than are there, Sister Verna.
She smiled in spite of herself.
Did you know, Warren, that I was once smitten with you?
He was so astonished he stumbled back a step.
Me? You can't be serious.
When?
Oh, it was a long time ago. Well over 100 years, I would suppose. You were so scholarly and intelligent, with all that curly blonde hair, and those blue eyes made my heart race.
Sister Verna! She couldn't hold back a chuckle as his face went crimson.
It was long ago, Warren, and I was young, as were you. It was a fleeting infatuation.
Her smile ghosted away.
Now you seem a child to me, and I look old enough to be your mother. Being away from the palace has aged me in more ways than one. Out there, you will have a few brief decades to learn what you could before you grow old and die. Here, you would have the time to learn and perhaps become a prophet. Books from those places could always be borrowed and brought here for study. You're the closest thing we have to a prophet. With the prelate and Nathan dead, you may know more about prophecies than anyone alive now. We need you, Warren.
He turned to the sunlight shimmering off the spires and roofs of the palace.
I'll think on it, sister. That's all I ask, Warren.
With a sigh, he turned back.
What now? Who do you think will be chosen as the new prelate?
They had learned through their research of the funeral rite that the process of selecting a new prelate was quite involved. Warren would know of it. Few knew the books in the vaults as well as he. She shrugged.
The post requires vast experience and knowledge. That means it would have to be one of the older sisters. Leoma Marsick would be a likely candidate. Or Philippa. Or Dulcinea. Sister Marin, of course, would be a top nominee. There are any number of qualified sisters. I could name at least 30, though I doubt that more than a dozen truly have a serious chance to become prelate.
He absently rubbed the side of his nose with a finger.
I suppose you're right.
Sister Verna had no doubt that sisters were already maneuvering to place themselves in contention, if not at the top of the list, with the less venerated choosing their champion and forming rank to back her, doing their best to see to it that she was selected, and hoping to be awarded a position of influence if their favorite became the new prelate. As the field of candidates narrowed, the more influential sisters, who hadn't yet chosen sides, would be courted until they were won over to one or another of the leading sisters. It was a momentous decision, one that would affect the palace for hundreds of years to come. It would likely be a bitter battle. Sister Verna sighed.
I don't look forward to the struggle, but I guess that the selection process must be rigorous, so that the strongest will become prelate. It could drag on for a long time. We could be without a prelate for months, maybe a year.
Who are you going to support, sister? She barked a laugh.
Me! You're only seeing the wrinkles again, Warren. They don't change the fact that I'm one of the younger sisters. I have no influence among those who would count.
Well, I think you had better try to get some influence. He leaned closer, lowering his voice even though there was no one around.
The 6 sisters of the Dark who escaped on that ship, remember?
She looked to his blue eyes and frowned.
What does that have to do with who will become prelate?
Warren twisted the robes at his stomach into a violet knot.
Who's to say there were only 6? What if there's another at the palace, or another dozen, or 100? Sister Verna, you're the only sister I trust to be a true sister of the light. You must do something to ensure that a sister of the Dark doesn't become prelate.
She glanced to the palace in the distance.
I told you, I'm one of the younger sisters. My word holds no sway. And the others know that the sisters of the Dark all escaped.
Warren looked away, trying to smooth out the wrinkles in his robes. Suddenly he turned back, suspicion creasing his brow.
You think I'm right, don't you? You think there are still sisters of the Dark at the palace?
She met his intense eyes with a placid expression.
While I don't think it entirely out of the realm of possibility, there is no reason to believe it is so, and beyond that, it is only one of a great many matters that must be taken into consideration when— Don't give me that double talk. It comes so easily to sisters. This is important.
Sister Verna stiffened.
You are a student, Warren, speaking to a sister of the light. Show the proper respect. I'm not being disrespectful, sister. Richard helped me to see that I must stand up for myself and for what I believe. Besides, you're the one who took my collar off and as you said, we're the same age. You are not my elder. You are still a student who you herself said probably knows more about the prophecies than anyone else. In that, sister, you are my student. I admit that you know more than I about a great many things, like the use of Han, but I know more than you about some things. Part of the reason you took the rod of Han from around my neck is because you know it's wrong to hold someone captive. I respect you as a sister, and for the good you do, and for the knowledge you have, but I am no longer a captive of the sisters. You have earned my respect, sister, not my submission.
She studied his blue eyes for a long moment.
Who would have known what was under that collar? At last she nodded. You're right, Warren. I suspect there are others at the palace who have given a soul oath to the keeper himself.
Others? Warren searched her eyes.
You didn't say sisters, you said others. You mean young wizards, too, don't you?
Have you so soon forgotten Jedediah? He paled a little.
No, I haven't forgotten Jedediah.
As you said, where there is one, there could be others. Some of the young men at the palace could be sworn to the keeper, too.
He hunched closer to her as he knotted his robes again.
Sister Verna, what are we going to do about it? We can't allow a sister of the dark to become prelate. It would be a disaster. We must be sure one of them doesn't become prelate.
And how would we know if she was sworn to the keeper?
Worse, what could we do about it? They have command of subtractive magic, we don't. Even if we could find out who they are, we couldn't do anything about it. It would be like reaching into a sack and grabbing a viper by its tail.
Warren paled.
I never thought of that.
Sister Verna clasped her hands.
We'll think of something. Perhaps the Creator will guide us.
Maybe we could get Richard to return and help us, like he did with those six sisters of the dark. At least we've seen the last of those six. They'll never show their faces again. Richard put the fear of the Creator in them and sent them running.
And in the process, the prelate was hurt and later died, along with Nathan, she reminded him. Death walks with that man.
Not because he brings it, Warren protested. Richard is a war wizard. He fights for what's right, to help people. If he hadn't done as he did, the prelate and Nathan would have only been the beginning of all the death and destruction.
She squeezed his arm. Her tone softened.
Of course, you're right. We all owe Richard a great debt. But needing him and finding him are two different things. My wrinkles attest to that.
Sister Verna let her hand drop.
I don't think we can count on anyone but each other. We'll think of something.
Warren fixed her with a dark expression.
We had better. The prophecies hold ominous portent about the next prelate's reign.
Back in the city of Tanimura, they were once again surrounded by the incessant sound of drums coming from various directions, a booming, low-pitched, steady cadence that seemed to vibrate deep in her chest. It was unnerving, and, she supposed, meant to be. The drummers and their guards had arrived 3 days before the prelate's death, and in short order had set up their huge kettle drums at various stations around the city. Once they had started the slow, steady beat, it had not stopped day or night. Men took shifts at the drums so that they never ceased even for a moment. The pervasive sound had slowly set the people's nerves on edge, making everyone irritable and short-tempered, as if doom itself were lurking in the shadows, just out of sight, waiting to pounce. Instead of the usual shouting, talking, laughing, and music, a backdrop of eerie quiet added to the brooding mood. At the outskirts of the city, the indigent people who had erected lean-to shelters cowered in them, instead of engaging in conversation, hawking small items, washing clothes in buckets, or cooking on small fires as they usually did. Shopkeepers stood in doorways or at simple plank tables, set up to display their goods, their arms folded and scowls on their faces. Men pulling carts bent somberly to their tasks. People needing goods made their purchases quickly, making no more than a perfunctory examination of the wares. Children kept a hand clutched to their mother's skirts as their eyes darted about. Men whom she had seen playing at dice or other games in the past huddled against walls. In the distance, at the Palace of the Prophets, a single bell tolled every few minutes, as it had all the night before, and would until the sunset, announcing to all that the prelate was dead. The drums, however, had nothing to do with the prelate's death. Manned by soldiers, they announced the impending arrival of the emperor. Sister Verna met the troubled eyes of people she passed, She touched the heads of the scores who approached, seeking solace, and offered the Creator's blessing.
"I only remember kings," she said to Warren, "not this imperial order. Who is this emperor?"
"His name is Jagang. 10, maybe 15 years ago, the imperial order started swallowing up the kingdoms, joining them together under its rule." With one finger, he rubbed his temple in thought.
"I spent most of my time in the vault studying, you understand, so I'm not sure of all the details, but from what I gather, they swiftly came to dominate the old world, joining it all under their rule. The emperor hasn't ever caused any trouble, though, at least not way up here in Tanimura. He stays out of palace business and expects us to stay out of his."
"Why is he coming here?"
Warren shrugged.
"I don't know. Perhaps just to visit this part of his empire."
After conferring the Creator's blessing on a gaunt woman, Sister Verna stepped around a trail of fresh horse dung as she resumed walking.
"Well, I wish he would hurry up and get here so that infernal drumming would cease. They've been at it 4 days now. His arrival must be imminent."
Warren glanced around before speaking.
"The palace guards are Imperial Order troops. As a courtesy, the Emperor provides them, since he allows no men-at-arms but his own. Anyway, I talked to one of the guards, and he told me that the drums are only meant to announce that the Emperor is coming, not that he will be here soon. He said that when the Emperor visited Breston, the drums sounded for nearly 6 months beforehand."
6 months? You mean we must endure this racket for months?"
Warren hitched up his robes and stepped over a puddle.
"Not necessarily. He could arrive in months or tomorrow. He doesn't deign to announce when he will arrive, only that he will."
Sister Verna scowled.
"Well, if he doesn't arrive soon, the sisters will see to it that those infernal drums stop."
That would be fine by me, but this emperor sounds like someone not to be treated casually. I've heard that he has an army more vast than any ever assembled."
He gave her a meaningful look.
"And that includes the great war that separated the old world from the new."
Her eyes narrowed.
"Why would he need such an army if he has already seized all of the old kingdoms?
Sounds to me like it's just idle talk of soldiers. Soldiers always like to boast." Warren shrugged.
"The guards told me they've seen it with their own eyes. They said that when the order masses, they cover the ground in every direction as far as the eye can see. What do you think the palace will make of it when he comes here?"
"Bah! The palace has no interest in politics."
Warren grinned.
"You never were one to be intimidated."
"Our business is with the Creator's wishes, not an emperor's, that's all. The palace will remain long after he is gone."
After walking in silence for a time, Warren cleared his throat.
"You know, way back, when we hadn't been here long and you were still a novice, well, I was enamored of you."
Sister Verna stared over incredulously.
"Now you're mocking me."
"No, it's true."
His face reddened.
"And I thought your curly brown hair was the most beautiful I'd ever seen. You were smarter than the others, and commanded your Han with sureness. I thought there was no one your equal. I wanted to ask you to study with me."
"Why didn't you?"
He shrugged.
"You were always so sure of yourself, so confident. I never was."
He brushed his hair back self-consciously.
"Besides, you were interested in Jedediah. I was nothing to compare to him. I always thought you would just laugh."
She realized she was smoothing back her hair and let her arm fall.
"Well, perhaps I would have."
She thought better of the slight.
"People can be foolish when they are young."
A woman with a young child approached and fell to her knees before them. Verna paused to bestow the Creator's blessing on them. As the woman thanked her and then hurried away, Sister Verna turned to Warren.
"You could go away for 20 years or so to study those books you are so interested in and catch up in age with me. We'd look the same age again. Then you could ask to hold my hand, like I wanted you to back then."
They both looked up at the sound of someone calling out to them. Through the throng of shuffling people, she saw one of the palace guard waving his arm to get their attention.
"Isn't that Kevin Andelmere?" she asked.
Warren nodded.
"I wonder what he's so stirred up about."
A breathless swordsman, Andelmere, vaulted over a small boy and stumbled to a halt before them.
"Sister Verna, good, I found you at last. They want you at the palace, right now."
"Who wants me? What about?"
He gulped air and tried to talk at the same time.
"The sisters want you. Sister Leoma grabbed me by my ear and told me to go find you and bring you back.
She said that if I was slow about it, I'd rue the day my mother bore me. There must be trouble.
What kind of trouble? He threw his hands up.
When I asked, she gave me that look sisters give that can melt a man's bones, and told me that it was sister business and none of mine.
Sister Verna let out a tired sigh.
I guess we best return with you then, or they'll skin you and use your hide for a flag.
The young soldier blanched, as if he believed her. Chapter 6 On the arched stone bridge that led over the River Kern to Halsbund Island and the Palace of the Prophets, Sister Philippa, Dulcinea, and Marin stood in a row, shoulder to shoulder, like three hawks watching their dinner approach. They clutched their hands impatiently at their waists. The sun at their backs cast their faces in shadow, but Sister Verna could still make out the scowls. Warren walked onto the bridge with her as Swordsman Andelmere, his duty accomplished, hurried off in another direction. Gray-haired Sister Dulcinea, her jaw set, leaned closer as Sister Verna came to a stop before her.
"Where have you been? You've kept everyone waiting."
The drums in the city kept up their beat in the background, like the slow drip of rain. Sister Verna put them from her mind.
"I've been for a walk, reflecting on the future of the palace and the Creator's work. What with Prelate Annalena's ashes hardly cold yet, I didn't suspect the backbiting was to begin so soon."
Sister Dulcinea leaned even closer, her penetrating blue eyes taking on a dangerous gleam.
"Don't you dare get impudent with us, Sister Verna, or you will quickly find yourself a novice again. Now that you have returned to life at the palace, you had better begin bethinking its ways, and start showing your superiors the proper respect."
Sister Dulcinea returned her back to straight, as if retracting claws, now that the threat had been delivered. She expected no argument. Sister Marin, a stocky woman with muscles like a woodsman and a tongue to match, smiled with satisfaction. Tall, dark Sister Philippa, her prominent cheekbones and narrow jaw giving her an exotic look, kept her dark eyes on Sister Verna, watching from behind an expressionless mask.
"Superiors," Sister Verna said. "We are all equal in the Creator's eyes."
"Equal," Sister Marin sniffed irritably. "An interesting concept. If we were to call an assembly of review to consider the matter of your contentious attitude, you would find out just how equal you are, and would likely find yourself once again doing chores with the rest of my novices. Only this time, you wouldn't have Richard here to intercede and get you out of it."
"Really, Sister Marin?"
Sister Verna lifted an eyebrow.
"Is that so?"
Warren inched behind her into her shadow.
"I seem to recall, and correct me if I'm mistaken, that the last time I got out of it, you said it was because you had prayed to the Creator, and it had come to you that I would best serve him if I were returned to Sister. Now you say it was Richard's doing. Am I mistaken in my recollection?"
"You would question me?"
Sister Marin pressed her hands together so tightly that her knuckles turned white.
"I was punishing insolent novices 200 years before you were born. How dare you?"
"You've now told two versions of the same event. Since both can't be true, that means that one would have to be untrue, yes? It would seem you have been caught in a lie, Sister Marin. I would think that you, of all people, would work to keep yourself from falling into the habit of lying. The Sisters of the Light hold honesty in high regard and abhor lying, even more than they abhor irreverence. And what penance has my superior, the headmistress of the novices, prescribed for herself to make amends for lying?"
"My, my," Sister Dulcinea said with a smirk. "Such boldness! Were I you, Sister Verna, and thinking of placing myself in contention for prelate, as you seem to be doing, I would get that presumptuous notion right out of my head. When Sister Leoma was through with you, there wouldn't be enough left for her to pick her teeth with."
Sister Verna returned the smirk.
"So, Sister Dulcinea, you intend to back Sister Leoma, yes? Or are you just trying to conjure a task to get her out of your way while you seek the post?"
Sister Philippa spoke up in a quiet, authoritative voice.
"Enough. We have more important matters to attend. Let's get this sham over with so we can get on with the selection process."
Sister Verna planted her fists on her hips.
"And just what sham would that be?"
Sister Philippa turned gracefully toward the palace, her simple but elegant yellow robe flowing behind.
"Follow us, Sister Verna. You have delayed us long enough. You are the last, and then we can be on with our business. We will take up the matter of your insolence at another time."
The other two sisters fell in beside her as she glided off over the bridge. Sister Verna and Warren exchanged a questioning look and then started after them. Warren slowed his pace, letting the three sisters lengthen their lead to a dozen paces. With a frown, he leaned close so he could whisper without them hearing.
Sister Verna, I sometimes think you could make a sunny day angry with you. It's been so peaceful around here for the last 20 years that I had forgotten how much trouble that tongue of yours could cause. Why do you do this? Do you just enjoy making trouble to no good end?
He rolled his eyes at her withering scowl and changed the subject.
What do you suppose those three are doing together? I thought they would be adversaries.
Sister Verna glanced to the three sisters to make sure they couldn't hear.
If you want to put a knife in the back of your opponent, so to speak, you must first get close enough.
In the heart of the palace, before the thick walnut doors to the great hall, the three sisters came to such an abrupt halt that Sister Verna and Warren almost ran up onto their heels. The three turned. Sister Philippa put the fingertips of one hand to Warren's chest and forced him back a step. She lifted one long, graceful finger to his face, letting it hover an inch from his nose as she fixed him with a cold glare.
This is sister business. She glanced to his bare neck. And after the new prelate, whoever she may be, is installed, you will have to have a Radahan put back around your neck if you wish to remain at the Palace of the Prophets. We will not abide boys who cannot be properly controlled.
Sister Verna anchored an unseen hand on the small of Warren's back to keep him from retreating.
I took his collar off under my authority as a Sister of the Light. The commitment has been made on behalf of the palace. It will not be reversed.
Sister Philippa's dark gaze slid to her.
We will discuss this matter later, at an appropriate time.
Let's be finished with this, Sister Dulcinea said. We need to be on with more important business.
Sister Philippa nodded.
Come with us, Sister Verna.
Warren stood hunched, looking lost, as one of the sisters used her hand to cast open the heavy doors, allowing the three to march through. Not wanting to look like a scolded puppy following them in, Sister Verna quickened her pace to walk beside them instead. Sister Dulcinea let out a noisy breath. Sister Marin invoked one of her famous looks, with which unfortunate novices were so familiar, but she didn't voice a protest. Sister Philippa showed the slightest hint of a smile. Anyone watching might have thought that it had been at her direction that Sister Verna walked beside them. At the inner edge of the low ceiling, between white columns with gold capitals carved to portray curled oak leaves, they came to a halt where Sister Leoma waited with her back to them. She was about Sister Verna's size. Her shock of straight white hair, tied loosely with a single golden ribbon, hung halfway down her back. She wore a modest brown dress that cleared the floor by a scant inch. Beyond, the great hall opened into a vast chamber, capped with a huge vaulted ceiling. Stained glass windows behind the upper balcony cast colored light across the ribbed dome, painted with the figures of sisters, attired in the old style of robes, surrounding a glowing figure meant to represent the Creator. His arms outstretched, he looked to be extending his affection to the sisters, all of whom, in turn, had their arms extended tenderly toward him. At the ornate stone railings of the two-tiered balconies ringing the room, sisters and novices stood silently gazing down. Around the polished, zigzag-patterned floor stood sisters, those, Sister Verna noted, mostly older and of higher status. Sporadic coughs echoed around the huge room, but no one spoke. In the center of the room, beneath the figure representing the Creator, stood a single, waist-high, white, fluted column, bathed in a faint glow of light. The light had no apparent source. The ring of sisters stood well back from the column and its obscure shroud of illumination, giving it as much room as possible, as well they should, if the glow was what Sister Verna suspected. A small object, she couldn't tell what, sat atop the flat-topped column. Sister Leoma turned.
Ah, glad to have you join us, sister. Is that what I think it is? Sister Verna asked.
A slight smile crooked the creases lining Sister Leoma's face.
If you are thinking it's a light web, then it is. Not half of us, I would venture, have the talent or power to spin one. Quite remarkable, don't you think?
Sister Verna squinted, trying to tell what sat on the column.
I've never seen that pedestal before, not in here anyway. What is it? Where did it come from?
Sister Philippa stared at the white pillar in the center of the room. Her arrogant demeanor had vanished.
When we came back from the funeral, it was here, waiting.
Sister Verna glanced back to the pedestal.
What's atop it?
Sister Leoma clasped her hands.
It's the prelate's ring, her ring of office.
The prelate's ring! What in creation is it doing there?
Sister Philippa lifted an eyebrow.
What indeed?
Sister Verna could just detect a hint of disquiet in those dark eyes.
Well, what is...
Just go and try to pick it up, Sister Dulcinea said.
Not that you will succeed, of course, she added under her breath.
We don't know what it's doing here, Sister Leoma said, her voice taking on a more familiar sister-to-sister intonation. When we came back, it was here. We've tried to examine it, but we can't get close. In view of the peculiar nature of the shield, we reasoned that before we proceed, it would be wise to see if there are any of us who could get near and maybe discern the purpose. We've all tried to approach, but none can. You are the last to endeavor to reach it.
Sister Verna drew up her shawl.
What happens when you try to approach?
Sisters Dulcinea and Marin looked away. Sister Philippa held Sister Verna's gaze.
It is not pleasant. Not pleasant at all.
Sister Verna wasn't surprised by that. It surprised her only that no one had been hurt.
It borders on criminal behavior to ignite a light shield and leave it where some innocent could accidentally walk into it.
Not likely, Sister Leoma said. Not considering where it is, anyway. The cleaning staff found it. They were wise enough to stay away.
It was ominous in the extreme that none of the sisters had been able to break the shield to get to the ring, as Sister Verna was positive they had attempted. It would be a significant accomplishment if one of them could demonstrate that she had the power to recover the prelate's ring on her own. She glanced over at Sister Leoma.
Have you tried linking webs to drain the shield?
Sister Leoma shook her head.
We decided that first, each would be given a chance, on the theory that it might be a shield keyed to an individual sister. We don't know what could possibly be the purpose of that, but if true, and it is a defensive shield, then linking and trying to drain its power could very well destroy what is being protected. You're the only one who hasn't tried.
She let out a tired sigh.
We even brought Sister Simona up here.
Sister Verna lowered her voice in the sudden silence.
Is she any better?
Sister Leoma stared up at the painting of the Creator.
She still hears voices, and last night, while we were up on the hill, had another of her deranged dreams.
Go and see if you can retrieve the ring so we can get back to the selection process,
Sister Dulcinea said. She shot a forbidding look at Sister Philippa and Leoma, as if to say there had been enough talking. Sister Philippa noted the look without expression or comment. Sister Marin glanced impatiently to the soft glow under which sat the object of their desire. Sister Leoma gestured with a gnarled hand toward the white column.
Verna, dear, bring us the ring if you are able. We have palace business to get back to. If you are not able, well, then we will be forced to use a link to drain the shield and attempt to retrieve the prelate's ring. Go now, child.
Sister Verna took a deep breath, deciding not to make an issue of being called child by another sister, a peer, and started off across the polished floor, her footfalls echoing around the vast room, the only sound except the muted, distant beat of drums. Sister Leoma was an elder, she supposed, and due a certain amount of deference. She glanced up toward the balconies and saw her friends, sisters Amelia, Phoebe, and Janet, offering her weak smiles. Sister Verna set her jaw and marched onward. She couldn't imagine what the prelate's ring would be doing under such a dangerous shield, a shield of light. Something was wrong. Her breath quickened at the thought that it might be the doing of a sister of the dark. One of them might have keyed the shield to her, suspecting she knew too much. Her pace slowed a bit. If that were true, and it was a trick to eliminate her, she very well could be incinerated without so much as a hint of warning. Only the sound of her footsteps echoed in her ears as she felt the outer bounds of the web. She could see the glint off the gold ring. Muscles tense, she expected something unpleasant, as the others had obviously experienced, but she felt only warmth, like a summer sun. Slowly, step by step, she proceeded, but it grew no hotter. By the few small gasps she heard, she knew that none of the others had gotten this far. She also knew that that didn't mean she would be able to go all the way or to escape. Through the soft white glow, she could see the sisters beyond, their eyes wide as they watched. And then, as if in the hazy light of a dream, she was standing before the pedestal. The light at the center of the shield had become bright enough that she couldn't make out the faces of those beyond. The prelate's gold ring sat on a folded piece of parchment, sealed closed with red wax, imprinted with a sunburst pattern from the ring. Writing was partially visible underneath the ring.
Sliding the ring to the side, she turned the parchment with one finger so she could read it. If you wish to escape this web alive, put the ring on the third finger of your left hand, kiss it, then break the seal and read my words inside to the other sisters, it said, and was signed, Prelate Annalena Alderin. Sister Verna stared at the words. They seemed to stare back, waiting. She didn't know what to do. She recognized the prelate's handwriting all too well, but realized it could be a forgery. If it was a dark sister's trick, especially one with a flair for the dramatic, following the instructions could kill her. If it wasn't, then not following them could. She stood frozen a moment, trying to come up with alternatives. None would come to mind. Sister Verna reached out and picked up the ring. Gasps of surprise came from the darkness beyond. She turned the ring over in her fingers, inspecting the sunburst pattern and the wear of age. It was warm to the touch, as if heated from an inner source. It looked like the prelate's ring, and a feeling in her gut told her it was. She glanced down at the words on the parchment again. If you wish to escape this web alive, put the ring on the third finger of your left hand, kiss it, then break the seal and read my words inside to the other sisters. Prelate Annalena Alderin. Sister Verna, her breath coming shallow and labored, slipped the ring onto the third finger of her left hand. She brought the hand to her lips and kissed the ring as she said a silent prayer to the Creator, seeking guidance and strength. She flinched as a beam shot from the figure of the Creator above her, bathing her in a bright shaft of light. The air about her fairly hummed. There were short, clipped screams and squeals from the sisters around the room, but in the light as she was, she could not see them. Sister Verna lifted the parchment in her trembling fingers. The air hummed more intensely. She wanted to run, but broke the wax seal instead. The shaft of light coming from the image of the Creator above intensified to blinding brilliance. Sister Verna unfolded the parchment and looked up, though she couldn't see the faces around her. Upon penalty of death, I am directed to read this letter. No one made a sound, so she looked down at the neatly scribed words. It says, Know all those assembled, and those not here, my last command. Sister Verna paused and swallowed as sisters gasped. These are trying times, and the palace can ill afford a protracted battle to succeed me. I will not allow it. I am exercising my prerogative as prelate, as set down in palace canon, to name my successor. She stands before you, wearing the ring of her office. The sister reading this is now prelate. The sisters of the light will obey her, all will obey her. The spell I have left over the ring was drawn with the aid and guidance of the Creator himself. Defy my bidding at your peril. To the new prelate, you are charged to serve and protect the palace of the prophets and all it stands for. May the light cradle and guide you always. In my own hand, before I pass from this life into the gentle hands of the Creator, Prelate Annalena Alderin. With a boom that shook the ground beneath her feet, the beam of light and the glow around her extinguished. Verna Soventrine let the hand holding the letter fall to her side as she looked up into the circle of stunned faces. The vast hall filled with a soft rustle as the sisters of the light began going to a knee and bowing their heads to their new prelate. This can't be, she whispered to herself. As she shuffled across the polished floor, she let the letter slip from her fingers. Sisters cautiously scurried in behind to snatch it up, to read for themselves the last words of Prelate Annalena Alderin. The four sisters came to their feet as she approached. Sister Marin's fine, sandy hair framed an ashen face. Sister Dulcinea's blue eyes were wide, and her face red. Sister Philippa's usually placid expression was now a picture of consternation. Sister Leoma's wrinkled cheeks spread in a kindly smile. You will be in need of advice and guidance, Prelate. Her smile was spoiled by the way she swallowed involuntarily. We will be available to help in any way we can. Please consider us at your disposal. We are here to serve. Thank you, Verna said in a weak voice as she started out again, her feet seeming to move of their own accord. Warren waited outside. She pushed the doors closed and stood in a daze before the young, blonde-headed wizard. Warren went to a knee in a deep bow. Prelate. He glanced up with a grin. I was listening at the door, he explained. Don't call me that, her own voice sounded hollow to her. Why not? It's who you are now. His grin grew. She turned and started away, her mind at last beginning to function again.
Come with me.
Where are we going?
Verna crossed her lips with a finger and over her shoulder shot him a scowl that snapped his mouth shut. Warren scurried to catch up with her as she marched off. Once beside her, he lengthened his stride to keep pace as she proceeded out of the Palace of the Prophets.
Whenever he looked as if he might open his mouth again, she crossed her lips with a finger. He at last sighed, stuffed his hands in the opposite sleeves of his robes, and set his gaze ahead as he strode along beside her. Novices and young men outside the palace, who had heard the riot of bells proclaiming the new prelate named, saw the ring and bowed. Verna kept her eyes ahead as she passed them. The guards on the bridge over the River Kern bowed as she crossed. Once over the river, she descended to the bank and walked along the path through the rushes. Warren hurried to keep up with her as she passed the small docks, all empty now, the boats out on the river with their fishermen casting nets or dragging lines as they rowed slowly upriver. They would soon be returning to sell their fish at the market in the city. A ways upriver from the Palace of the Prophets, at a deserted, flat patch of ground near an outcropping of rock, around which the water gurgled and splashed, she came to a halt. Scowling into the swirling water, she planted her fists on her hips. "I swear, if that meddlesome old woman wasn't dead, I'd strangle her with my bare hands."
"What are you talking about?" Warren asked.
"The prelate. If she weren't in the hands of the Creator right now, I'd have mine around her throat."
Warren chuckled.
"That would be quite the sight, prelate."
"Don't call me that!"
Warren frowned.
"But that's who you are now, the prelate."
She snatched his robes at each shoulder in her fists.
"Warren, you have to help me. You have to get me out of this."
"What? But this is wonderful. Verna, you're prelate now."
"No, I can't be."
"Warren, you know all the books down in the vaults. You've studied palace law. You have to find something to get me out of this. There has to be a way. You can find something in the books that will prevent this."
"Prevent it? It's done. And besides, this is the best thing that could happen."
He cocked his head to the side.
"Why did you bring me way down here?"
She released his robes.
"Warren, think. Why was the prelate killed?"
"She was killed by Sister Eulysia, one of the Sisters of the Dark. She was killed because she fought their evil."
"No, Warren. I said think. She was killed because one day, in her office, she told me that she knew about the Sisters of the Dark. Sister Eulysia was one of her administrators, and she overheard the prelate voice her knowledge."
She leaned toward him.
"The room was shielded. I made sure of it. But what I didn't realize at the time is that the Sisters of the Dark might be able to use subtractive magic. Sister Eulysia heard right through the shield and came back to kill the prelate. Out here, we could see if anyone is close enough to hear us talk. There's no corner for them to be hiding around."
She nodded toward the babbling water.
"And the water masks the sound of our voices."
Warren glanced nervously about.
"I see what you mean. But, prelate, water can sometimes carry sounds quite a distance." "I said stop calling me that! With the sounds of the day all about, and if we speak softly, the water will mask our voices. We can't risk talking about any of this in the palace. If we must discuss any of this, we must always go out into the country, where we can see if anyone is close. Now, I need you to find a way for me to be removed from the post of prelate."
Warren sighed out in exasperation.
"Stop saying that. You're qualified to be prelate, perhaps more qualified than any of the other sisters. Besides experience, the prelate must be one with exceptional power."
He looked away when she lifted an eyebrow.
"I have unlimited access to anything in the vaults. I've read the reports."
His gaze returned.
"When you captured Richard, the other two sisters died, and in so doing passed their power on to you. You have the power, the Han of three sisters."
"That is scarcely the only requirement, Warren."
He leaned forward. "As I said, I've unlimited access to the books. I know the requirements. There is nothing that would disqualify you. You fit all the requirements. You should be elated to be prelate. This is the best thing that could happen."
Sister Verna sighed.
"Have you lost your wits along with your collar? What possible reason would I have for wanting to be prelate?"
"Now we can ferret out the Sisters of the Dark."
Warren smiled confidentially. "You will have the authority to do what must be done."
His blue eyes sparkled.
"Like I said, this is the best possible thing that could happen."
She threw her hands up.
"Warren, my becoming prelate is the worst possible thing that could happen. The mantle of authority is as restricting as the collar you're so happy to be rid of."
Warren frowned.
"What do you mean?"
She smoothed back her curly brown hair.
"Warren, the prelate is a prisoner of her authority. Did you often see Prelate Annalena?"
"No.
And why not?"
"Because she was in her office, overseeing the administration of the Palace of the Prophets. She had 1,000 things to attend to,
A thousand questions that demanded her attention, hundreds of sisters and young men that needed to be overseen, including the constant dilemma of Nathan. You don't know the kind of trouble that man could cause. He had to be kept under constant guard. The prelate could never drop in to visit a sister or a young man in training. They would be in a panic, wondering what they had done wrong, what the prelate had been told about them. The prelate's conversations can never be casual. They are always charged with the perception of hidden meaning. It's not because she wants it that way. It's simply that she holds a position of sweeping authority, and no one can ever forget that. When she ventures out of her complex, she is immediately surrounded by the pomp and ceremony of her office. If she goes to the dining hall to have dinner, no one has the courage to carry on with their conversation. Everyone sits silently and watches her, hoping she won't look their way, or, worse yet, asks them to join her at her table. Warren wilted a little. I never thought about it that way. If your suspicions about the Sisters of the Dark are true, and I'm not saying they are, then being prelate would hinder my discovering who they are. It didn't hinder Prelate Annalena. Do you know that? Maybe if she wasn't prelate, she would have discovered them ages ago, when she would have been able to do something about it. She might have been able to eradicate them before they began killing our boys and stealing their Han and became so powerful. As it was, her discovery came too late and only resulted in her death. They may fear your knowledge and reveal themselves in some way. If there are Sisters of the Dark in the palace, then they know of my involvement in discovering the six who escaped, and if anything, will be glad to have me be prelate so as to tie my hands and keep me out of the way. Warren touched a finger to his lip. But it must be of some help to have you be prelate. It will only prove a hindrance in stopping the Sisters of the Dark. Warren, you have to help me. You know the books. There must be something that can get me out of this. Prelate. Stop calling me that! Warren winced in frustration. But that's who you are. I can call you no less. She sighed. The prelate, Prelate Annalena, asked her friends to call her Anne. If I am the prelate now, then I ask you to address me as Verna. Warren thought it over with a frown. Well, I guess we are friends. Warren, we are more than friends. You are the only one I can trust. There is no one else now. He nodded. Verna, then. He twisted his mouth as he thought. Verna, you're right. I know the books, I know the requirements, and you fit them all. You're young for a prelate, but only by precedent. There's no prohibition in law about age. But more than that, you have the Han of three sisters. There is no sister of the light anyway, who is your equal. That in itself makes you more than qualified. Power, the command of Han, is a prime consideration to be prelate. Warren, there has to be something. Think. His blue eyes reflected the depth of his knowledge and regret. Verna, I know the books. They're explicit. Once lawfully named, they specifically forbid the prelate from abandoning her duty. Only in death may she cede the calling. Short of Annalena Alderaan coming back to life and reclaiming her office, there is no way for you to disqualify yourself or to resign. You are a prelate. Verna could think of no solution. She was trapped. That woman has been twisting my life for as long as I can remember. She keyed that spell to me. I know she did. She trapped me into this. I wish I could strangle her. Warren laid a gentle hand to her arm. Verna, would you ever allow a Sister of the Dark to become prelate? Of course not. Do you think Anne would? No, but I don't see... Verna, you said you can trust none but me. Think of Anne. She was trapped too. She couldn't allow the chance of one of them becoming prelate. She was dying. She did the only thing she could. She could trust no one but you. Verna stared into his eyes as his words echoed in her mind, and then she slumped down on a smooth, dark rock beside the water. Her face sank into her hands. Dear Creator, she whispered. Am I this selfish? Warren sat down beside her. Selfish? Stubborn at times, but never selfish. Oh, Warren, she must have been so lonely. At least she had Nathan there with her. At the end, Warren nodded. After a moment, he glanced over at her. We're in a lot of trouble, aren't we, Verna? A whole palace full of it, Warren. All wrapped up nice and neat with a gold ring. Chapter 7 Richard covered his mouth as he yawned. He was so tired from not getting any sleep the night before, or much for that matter in the last 2 weeks, to say nothing of the fight with Mriswith, that it was a struggle to put one foot in front of the other. The smells ran from foul to fragrant and back again seemingly every few paces, As he progressed through the convoluted maze of streets, staying close to the buildings and out of the thickest of the commotion, while trying his best to follow the directions Mistress Sanderholt had given him, he hoped he wasn't lost. Always knowing where he was and how he was going to get to where he was going was a matter of honor for a guide, but since Richard had been a woods guide, he guessed it could be pardoned if he did become lost in a great city. Besides, he was no longer a woods guide, nor did he expect he would ever be one again. He knew where the sun was, though, and no matter what the streets and buildings did in their efforts to confuse him with their teeming thoroughfares, dark alleys, and warrens of narrow, twisting side streets among ancient, windowless buildings laid out to no design, southeast was still southeast. He simply used taller buildings as landmarks, instead of monarch trees or prominent terrain, and tried not to worry about the exact streets he was supposed to follow. Richard was weaving his way through the throngs of people, past shabbily dressed hawkers with pots of dried roots, baskets of pigeons, fish, and eels, charcoal makers pushing carts and calling out the price in song, past cheesemongers outfitted in crisp red and yellow livery, butcher shops with pig, sheep, and stag carcasses hung on spike racks, salt cellars offering different grades and textures, shopkeepers selling breads, pies and pastries, poultry, spices, sacks of grain, barrels of wines and ale, and 100 other items displayed in windows or on tables outside shops, and past people inspecting the wares, chatting, and complaining about the prices, when he realized the flutter in his gut was a warning. He was being followed. Suddenly, wide awake, he turned and saw a crush of faces, but none he recognized. He held his black cape over his sword so as not to draw attention to himself. At least the ever-present soldiers didn't seem particularly interested in him, although some of the Dharans looked up when he passed near, as if they could sense something, but couldn't place its source. Richard hurried his steps. The flutter was so faint that he thought maybe those who followed weren't close enough for him to see them. But then, how was he to know who it was? It could be any of the faces he saw. He glanced at the rooftops, but didn't see the one he knew was following him, and instead checked the direction of the sunlight to help keep his bearings. He paused near a corner building to watch the people flowing up and down the street, looking for anyone watching him, anyone who looked out of place or unusual, but saw nothing alarming.
"Honey cake, my lord?"
Richard turned to a small girl in a too-big coat standing behind a rickety little table. He guessed her to be 10 or 12, but he wasn't good at guessing young girls' ages. "What was that?" She swept a hand over the wares on her table.
"Honey cake. My grandmama makes them. They're right good, I can tell you, and only a penny. Would you buy one, please, my lord? You won't be sorry."
On the ground behind the girl, a stocky old woman in a tattered wrap of brown blanket sat on a board placed over the snow. She grinned up at him. Richard only half-smiled back as he probed his inner flutter, trying to determine what he was sensing, trying to determine the nature of the foreboding. The girl and old woman smiled hopefully and waited. Richard glanced up the street again, and then, letting a long cloud of his breath stream away in the light breeze, fished around in his pocket. He had had precious little to eat in his 2-week run to Aidendrill and was still weak. All he had was silver and gold from the Palace of the Prophets. He doubted his pack back at the Confessor's Palace had any pennies in it either. "I'm not a lord," he said as he put all but a silver back into his pocket. The girl pointed at his sword.
"Anyone with a fine sword the likes of that must be a lord, surely."
The old woman had stopped smiling. With her eyes fixed on his sword, she rose to her feet. Richard hastily pulled his cape across the hilt and the silver and gold worked scabbard and handed the girl the coin. She stared at it in her palm.
"I've not enough small money to make change for this much, my lord. Bless me, I don't even know how much small money it would take. I've never held a silver coin before."
"I told you, I'm not a lord," he smiled when she looked up. "My name's Richard.
Tell you what, why don't you just keep the coin and consider the extra as payment in advance? Then whenever I pass this way again, well, you can give me another of your honey cakes for the bargain until the silver is used up."
"Oh, my lord! I mean, Richard, thank you!" Beaming, the girl handed the coin to her grandmama. The old woman inspected the silver coin with a critical eye as she turned it in her fingers.
"I've not seen marks like these before. You must have traveled a long way."
The woman would have no way of knowing where the coin was from. The old and new worlds had been separated for the last 3,000 years.
"I have. The silver is real enough, though."
She gazed up with blue eyes that looked as if the years had washed out nearly all the color.
"Taken or given, my lord?"
And Richard's brow creased, she gestured.
"That sword of yours, my lord, did you take it, or was it given to you?"
Richard held her gaze at last, understanding. The Seeker was meant to be appointed by a wizard, but since Zed had fled the Midlands many years past, the sword had become a prize among those who could afford it, or those who could steal it. Pretend Seekers had given the Sword of Truth a nefarious reputation, and were not to be trusted. They used the sword's magic for selfish reasons, and not as it had been intended by those who had invested their magic in the blade. Richard was the first in decades to have been named Seeker of Truth by a wizard. Richard understood the magic, its terrible power and responsibility. He was the true Seeker.
"It was given by one of the First Order. I was named," he said cryptically. She clutched the blanket to her buxom chest.
"A Seeker," she breathed through the gaps where teeth belonged. "The spirits be praised, a real Seeker."
The little girl, not understanding the conversation, peered at the coin in her grandmama's hand and then handed Richard the biggest honey cake on the table. He accepted it with a smile. The old woman leaned over the table a bit and lowered her voice.
"You've come to rid us of the vermin?"
Something like that. He took a bite of the honey cake. He smiled down at the girl again.
"It's as good as you promised."
She grinned.
"Told you so. Grandmama makes the best honey cakes on Stentor Street."
Stentor Street. At least he had managed to find the correct street. "Past the market on Stentor Street," Mistress Sanderholt had said. He winked at the girl while he chewed.
"What vermin?" he asked the old woman.
"My son," the old woman said as her eyes flicked down, indicating the girl, "and her mother. They've deserted us to stay near the palace, waiting for the gold promised. I told them to work, but they say I'm old and foolish in my ways, that they can be given more than they could earn if they just wait there for what's owed them."
"How do they reason it's owed them?" She shrugged.
"Because someone from the palace said so. Said they were entitled to it. Said all the people were. Some, like those two, believe it. It appeals to my son's lazy ways. The young are lazy nowadays, so they sit and wait to be given, to be taken care of, instead of seeing to their own needs. They fight over who should be given the gold first. Some of the weak and old have been killed in those fights. Meanwhile, fewer work, and so the prices keep going up. We can hardly afford enough bread now."
Her face set into a bitter expression.
"All because of a foolish lust for gold. My son had work, for Chalmer the baker, but now he waits to be handed gold instead of working, and she grows more hungry."
She glanced out of the corner of her eye at the girl and smiled kindly.
"She works, though. Helps me make my cakes, she does, so we can feed ourselves. I won't let her roam the streets like many of the young do now."
She looked up again with a somber expression.
"Them's the vermin. Them who take what little we can earn or make with our hands so as to promise it right back to us, expecting us to be thankful at their kind hearts. Them who tempt good people to be lazy, so they can rule us like they do sheep at a trough. Them who took our freedom and our ways. Even a foolish old woman like me knows that lazy people don't think for themselves. They only think about themselves. I don't know what the world's coming to."
When she finally seemed to have run out of breath, he gestured to the coin in her fist as he swallowed the mouthful of honey cake. Richard gave her a meaningful look.
"I'd appreciate it for now if you would forget about what my sword looks like."
She bobbed her head knowingly.
"Anything, anything for you, my lord. The good spirits be with you, and give the vermin a whack for me."
Richard moved up the street a ways and sat a moment on a barrel beside an alleyway to take a bite of his honey cake. It was good, but he wasn't really paying much attention to the taste, and it didn't do anything to quell the apprehensive feeling in his stomach. It wasn't the same feeling as when he sensed the Mriswith, he realized. It was more the feeling he had always gotten when someone's eyes were on him, and the fine hairs at the base of his neck stiffened. That was what he felt, someone watching him, someone watching and following. He scanned the faces, but didn't see anyone who looked as if they were interested in him. Licking the honey off his fingers, he wove his way across the street, around horses pulling carts and wagons, and between the crush of people going about their business. At times it was like trying to swim upriver. The din, the jangling of tack, the thud of hooves, the rattle of cargo and wagons, the creak of axles, the crunch of the compacted snow, the shouting of hawkers, the cries of hucksters, and the buzz of talking, some in a sing-song or a chatter of languages he didn't understand, was unnerving. Richard was used to the silence of his woods, where the wind in the trees or water rushing over rocks was the most sound he ever heard. Though he had often gone into Heartland, it was hardly more than a small town, and nothing to compare to the cities, like this one, that he had seen since he left home. Richard missed his woods. Kaelin had promised him that she would return there with him one day for a visit. He smiled to himself as he thought about the beautiful places he would take her, the overlooks, the falls, the hidden mountain passes. He smiled more at the thought of how astonished she would be, and at how happy they would be together.